honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting this week with Wayne Bailey of Turlock, California. Originally from Minnesota, he served on the light cruiser USS Biloxi during World War II. Did you ever get seasick?
First time. You know where they had me posted? We were right out of San Francisco, naturally, and that, you know how rough it is right there by the Golden Gate Bridge. Yeah. I'm setting sights on these 6-inch guns. There's four dials. Three of them raise and lower the guns this way, and the fourth one turns you around. And the gunner's mate calls these numbers off to you, and you set these dials just as fast as he calls them. Well, I was so seasick, they could have shot me, and I'd have been happy. I couldn't see the dials or nothing. I was so sick that first day. And I wasn't the only one. I mean, there was even some of the old salts, because that's rough water out there, really rough. But after that, when I went out again, I got woozy, of course, but not that sick. And then pretty soon, you're okay. I mean, I was anyway.
And you mentioned the old salts. Obviously, there were guys who had been on that ship a lot longer than you when you came aboard. Did they tell you all some of the stories of what they'd already been through in the war and some of their close calls?
Well, especially the kamikaze plane that come in. Because when you'd hear them, the planes, the ones on the 40s and the 20s were the main ones that would intercept those types of the 5- and 6-inch guns. I mean, they're no fight for the planes. And you'd hear them yell, DP, DP, I mean, death plane. And you'd know that particular plane, and you'd hear it. It has a different sound.
So, and you're saying that as if you experienced that.
Well, yeah, once in a while, there'd be one show up. Yeah, in the South China Sea, I remember them coming in. You knew that if they weren't strafing, you knew they had to be carrying a bomb, and you can hear it. And when I was taken off the powder room and I was put into the turret, the 6-inch guns, and that's how I knew that you had to set timers and stuff. And that was to shoot them up in the air, and the shrapnel would go out on the plane and damage them to some sort.
But when you're in these situations where you hear DP, DP, death plane, kamikaze, the context of that is these guys who've been on the ship told you about the time a kamikaze actually struck your ship.
Oh, yes.
And might have done a lot of damage, but the bomb didn't go off? Is that right?
No, didn't detonate.
So you're aware of what can happen
if
one of those planes strikes.
Absolutely. And they said it weighed 1,200 pounds. We mounted it on the side of the ship.
I see that here.
Oh, yeah. Or they mounted it.
So it was still there when you got on the ship?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. It was there when we put it in mothballs.
So when you came aboard the ship, you saw a Japanese bomb mounted on the ship.
Yeah, I didn't realize what it was until I was told. I mean, I just thought it was imitation, you know, some decoration type, just for some reason. I had no idea. And then they told me, especially when I got into the office, I got a lot of information.
What did they tell you about it?
Oh, it was just unbelievable. The ones on the 40s, as they told me, knew the pilot was dead. He was slumped when he come in, because they'd just about riddled his plane with the 20s. Evidently, none of the 40s hit it or anything. It came in, and that's the damage that it did. It entered the in where the planes were, and there's two 500-barrel plane fuel attached to the bulkhead. It creased those. When they told me about it, I went back and looked, and sure enough, they were still creased. It creased it and bulged the top a little bit.
So if that had been a little bit different, there wouldn't have been much ship left for you to get onto.
Well, there sure wouldn't, because that would have taken the whole works.
And you mentioned Wake Island.
Oh, yeah.
So this is, you know, Wake Island was taken the very first few days of the war, has been in Japanese hands since then, and your ship had a hand in taking it back.
Yeah, we sure did.
Is that something that was significant for you?
Yeah, it was for me, because I'd never had to go that long. It was a good 2 days.
You don't know this, but we're getting closer and closer to the end of the war at that point.
Absolutely.
I believe that was right before they dropped the bomb, right?
Yep. And we were all, the 7th and 6th Fleet were up in Okinawa. And boy, you saw a bunch of ships. That was it. We were so crowded that they had to stand watch so the ships wouldn't bump each other. And that's when my friend Don Billman called me from his ship in Buckner Bay, Okinawa. Next thing I got was a call for go to the radio shack, and there was a message. And I went there, and here was Don Billman had found out that I was on the Biloxi and contacted me. And that was the first time we'd ever encountered each other since we split up on Treasure Island. Anyway, so much for that. And then, like I said, all these ships were in there in this Buckner Bay. And then we got the report that a typhoon was headed for Buckner Bay. We were told that we had to get out of there because it was going to hit Buckner Bay. So everybody, all the ships started getting out. The wind changed, and we run right into the thing, the typhoon. And it just pounded. Oh, that was the worst part of my whole experience, I think, was the typhoon. You just can't believe the waves and stuff that it did. Naturally, nobody, everything is dogged down, everything. So if the ship went upside down, it would float.
So where were you on the ship as you're enduring that situation?
You aren't allowed out on the deck,
right,
at all on the typhoon. It's completely dogged down. Even then, we lost 2 men, and that was ridiculous. Back again to the deck, of course, the bosun mate reprimanded 2 sailors that had done something. I don't know what they'd done, because I helped write up the summary court-martial of it. But he sent them topside to empty a garbage can.
During a typhoon?
During a typhoon.
And got him killed.
Nobody was to be up there. Nobody. He sent them up there, and naturally, it caught the can and went over. 2 sailors lost them. And the light cruiser and above can't stop and pick up anyone. Are not supposed to, they say. And there was no way they could live in that water anyway, so that's what happened.
And where were you on the ship while you were going through the typhoon, and can you help us understand what that felt like, what that experience was like? In my mind, it seems like it would feel pretty helpless.
You are helpless. You can't do anything. Everything is bolted down. For instance, in our office, the typewriters and all that stuff is bolted down. The help is absolutely doing only what has to be done, because the cooks can't cook. All you're getting is a sandwich, always a sandwich, a pickle, and a slice of lemon. And we do absolutely nothing. Other than that, no. There was more head injuries, more broken arms, more broken legs during the typhoon than any other injuries on the ship.
So were you holding on to something?
Oh, yeah. You don't walk any further than you have to, because when you got to go through the hatch, you got to bend over and you whack your head, or you go to step and the ship tips and there's no step there then.
Were you frightened at all by that?
Frightened? Oh, even the portholes were dogged down because they could break, the
sure.
Glass could break. We'd hang on to different things there in the office and look out through the porthole there, and just unbelievable. And that ship would just pound when it'd go up and then come down, and broke the bow, cracked it. All small stores got wet.
When was that typhoon?
Before the atomic bomb. Because we thought we were there for the invasion of Japan. That was our talk, everything that we heard.
Sure.
We were ready to invade Japan. We used to enjoy Tokyo Rose every night. Where she got all that music that was the latest stuff there was, and no one could ever tell. My wife and I were real close in school and everything, and you listened to Tokyo Rose, and she would tell you stories about everything that was going on at home, and even the married guys, they'd pick on their wives,
So she made you wonder if you might get a Dear John letter, or your girlfriend found another guy?
Yep, they sure did. It made you wonder when you're gone a year and a half. A lot of things happen in that length of time, but nothing did in my case.
So was Betty writing you letters during the war?
Oh, yeah. We had a code fixed up.
You guys were already a couple?
Well, yeah, we high school. Like I said, I had to work a lot, and she'd come in and stand by the meat counter, and she and I'd visit on Saturday nights. One day, my dad went over to her, and he says, if you're going to come in here and talk to my son, he says, you might as well put an apron on and go to work. And you'd have to know my wife. She said, all right. Uh-huh. Where's the apron? And he went and got it, and she went to work, and she went to work for him.
So she was writing you letters while you're on the ship, and you said you devised a code. What can you tell me about that?
I would start the paragraph with the island or wherever the ship had entered or had fracas with. Like the worst one was the Philippines. I had a heck of a time writing that letter to start paragraphs with each one of the syllables of the Philippines.
So the first paragraph was P and then H and I?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a lot of paragraphs.
I didn't want to put them all on the front one page, so I'd write page after page.
Did they actually make it through to her without getting censored?
Yeah, and they might have been more lax at that time, too.
Later on in the war. Yeah.
But we thought we were pulling a good one anyway, so.
You mentioned the atomic bomb.
Yes.
And contact with your old high school buddy, Billman.
Yes.
Did all five of you guys who went in together, did y'all make it home?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes, they all did.
Good.
Not under the best conditions. One was an alcoholic, and Billman, he was kind of like me. He lost his hearing real bad. The guns in those days were real loud, real loud. And the strafing of the ship and stuff, it's hard on the ears.
Sure.
They just ring afterwards, you know.
So you've had trouble with your ears for 75-plus years, and also with your feet, I understand. Because you got caught taking a shower at the wrong time?
Because you take a shower with that many men, you take a shower whenever you can take it. There was probably 8 or 10 of us in the shower. You get submarine attack, they say. You hear the battle stations, and you know what you're supposed to do, because each one is different than the other. I mean, you know whether it's an air attack, you know whether it's a ship, you know whether it's a submarine or the different tones and so forth of the alert. So we knew we had to get topside. So if you're blowing, your chances are better because you'd be blowing off than if you're inside. You know that.
I mean, sure.
And so we're in the shower, and then first thing we hear is this battle station, and we just take off. I mean, it's all men on the ship, so it don't make any difference whether you're dressed or not. And we take off and run up topside. Well, of course, it's hotter than Billy Heck on that metal. And of course, we're on the metal and not on wood. Like, there is a wood deck, too, but we aren't close to that. And it's crowded up there, and some of them are laying down. A lot of times you're told to lay down or whatnot, but long as you're topside. So I didn't want to lay down in that heat, so I was standing. I burnt the bottoms of my feet on the metal, because I don't know how long now. We were there a long time, it seemed. And so I went to sick bay, and I went in with my feet, and I told him I burned them. And yeah, he said, you have. You burned them good. So he put some salve and stuff on them, and from now on, he says, you wear nothing but white socks. That's just what he told me to do. To this day, other than when I dress and so forth, I wear white socks when I worked. And my feet have, of course, they were burned, so they never sweat or do any of that stuff at all. They just stay dry all the time. And they work fine. I mean, I'm fine.
And so your ship went to evacuate some of those prisoners of
that's
war.
That's right. We went right into the dock in Nagasaki. It was the first stop.
And some of these guys have been prisoners for more than 3 years.
Oh, one of them especially that I got to know. It wasn't a long trip between Nagasaki and Okinawa. Okay. They got the men from the prison where they were, got them on the ship, and they got to remember there's 1,200 of us on the ship, and so where are you going to put hundreds of prisoners? Well, we used the hot bunk system. They slept at daytime, we slept at night in the same bunk. I'd get out of the bunk, he would get the man that was there in my bunk would get in, and that's where he would sleep. The one that was in my bunk was from what they call the Dutch East Indies Island, you know, the Dutch islands that they had. He was a Dutchman, so still American. I'll never forget him as long as I live. He was an older man. At least he looked older. I shouldn't say he was older because they all looked old. But he, in turn, finally, as we conversed, he showed me his hands. And I'm sorry.
Take your time.
All of his fingers were burnt with a cigarette. His fingernails. Both hands. For stealing a handful of rice because he was hungry. I'm sorry.
Oh,
And I thought I was a complainer because I didn't like the way the meat was cooked or something when it would come time to eat. And here was a man, damage for life. And then the other individual that I met is really a story. He was from Texas, and he went in at the same age that I did. And he was captured in 42. The ship went down, and he was picked up and captured. And he was just a young kid. And like I said, he was from Texas. His hair was snow white, snow white. And I went out on the deck. It was at night. And I went up on the deck, and naturally I noticed, like others did, his white hair. It was just as white as snow, really. So I went over to him, and because I saw him riding. I says, "What are you riding? Riding home?" "No, no," he said. "I'm not. I'm just figuring up how much money I got coming." He was using the $22 pay that he was getting when he went in. He was trying to figure out how much he was going to have coming when he could get paid. I'll never forget that as long as I live.
Did getting to know those two and seeing that whole collection of prisoners in the physical shape that they were in, did that give you some more perspective on the importance of what you and your shipmates were doing?
Oh, it did me, that's for sure. Because they told me they worked in the coal mines. They'd work there until they were just wore out, and then they were giving, we'd kind of call it them the ship Liberty, where they would be easier, and their work then was using a hammer, busting up rock, making a street or a road. That was what they got for coming out of the coal mine.
You know, you mentioned there that where you picked all of those ex-POWs up was Nagasaki.
And Hiroshima.
There's a reason that the names of those cities are so familiar to people all these years later. What did you get to see?
Oh, devastation, unbelievable.
They took you all in there?
They didn't take you in. You had to sneak in. They didn't know what the radiation and stuff.
What made you want to go in and inspect some of the damage?
Curiosity, I suppose. And an atomic bomb, I never heard of it. I had no idea what it was, even. You couldn't believe that one bomb would do what was done.
Well, you've been very generous with your time, and if there's anything else that's important for you to mention, feel free. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story. As you look back over your life, is there something you'd say you're most proud of or that you're most thankful for?
I would say my wife. She went with me in every business deal. She never looked back. Anything that I did, she was there 100%. She never looked back, always looked ahead.
Here's one more question for you. I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. If I picture you, you know, on the ship, when you're down in the powder room and one of those 8-inch shells from Wake Island goes off underneath your ship, or when you're on a gun crew and they're talking about kamikazes coming in, or when you're holding on for dear life in the typhoon, was there something that helped you, that you think helped you endure those moments that might get the best of some of the rest of us?
My Christian faith. God kept me healthy all the way.
I don't want to put words in your mouth. Are you saying that in some of those moments on the ship, you were talking to God a little bit?
You better believe it. Not only me, but the ones beside me.
Once again this week, the time went by way more quickly than we'd like. We're out of time on the radio, but we do have a few more of Mr. Bailey's World War II memories included in the podcast version of this episode, available at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.